Okay, does this one work if it's... Oh, that's nice. Most of them don't work when they're this far away from your mouth. I wanted to also add another verse to our morning chanting, the Four Immeasurables. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. So I think it is very important to remember those four immeasurables constantly and to keep invigorating them in our mind. Reciting them at the beginning of sessions is always very helpful, because that is what we want our approach to other sentient beings to be. Yeah, our usual approach to sentient beings is, what can you do for me? Yeah. Lama Yeshe once made a quite strong statement. He said, when we say, I love you, it means, I want to use you.
You're going, I don't agree with what Lama Yeshe said.
But, you know, often when, you know, when we say we love somebody, there's all sorts of conditions attached, you know, all sorts of strings. I love you as long as you do A, B, C, D, and, you know, and so on. And when the person doesn't do that, then we stop loving them, in a way. I mean, isn't this what happens a lot in the case of divorces? Am I hitting you with too much too early in the morning? But, you know, I think it's important for us to look at what do we mean by the word love. Because so often in our conventional language, love, I think, actually means attachment. No? It's not something impartial. It's certainly not spread to all beings. And even to the people we love, it's not something that is stable. Our love is not stable because it's very conditioned on how the other person treats us. Yeah, if they treat us well, we love them. If they don't treat us well, you know, we throw them from the friend camp into the enemy camp. Yeah, what we're trying to develop in Buddhist practice is a kind of love that doesn't depend on these conditions, and that is more stable. In other words, a love that the reason for loving somebody is not that they benefit us, not that they help us, not that they agree with our ideas and encourage us and think we're special, but we care for them simply because they exist. Because they're another living being just like us who wants to be happy and not suffer. Because they're a living being whose work in society benefits us, and who also in previous lives have benefited us. Yeah. So we see other sentient beings as kind, not because their benefit is directed towards me, remember me, the center of the universe, but because their efforts are something that I have benefited from. So our love doesn't have to be restricted to people we know, to people who say nice things about us, but it, you know, seeing that all beings have benefited us, even they don't know us, you know, either in this life or previous lives they benefited us, knowing that we... like we talked about yesterday, that we're able to stay alive simply because of others' kindness, then that in and of itself is enough reason to love somebody. And you can see that if we love others for that reason, then no matter what they do, that love can remain constant. It becomes much more stable. Rather than, I love you because you do something for me specially. Also, love in a Buddhist sense simply means we want somebody to have happiness and the causes of happiness. Yeah, that's all. I mean, love in our usual sense, you know, I expect you to fulfill all my needs. Do you think that's possible for one other person to fulfill all of your needs? If somebody came to you and said, I expect you to fulfill all of my needs. When I'm in a good mood, I expect you to be in a good mood. When I'm in a bad mood, I expect you to pull me out of my bad mood. Yeah. When I'm discouraged, you need to encourage me. When I'm afraid, you need to protect me. When whatever I'm interested in, you need to be interested in. When I feel like laughing, you better feel like laughing. You know. And somebody said, you know, I expect you to meet all my needs. What would you say? Would you go along with that? I wouldn't. It's like, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Yeah. I'm not capable of being everything you want me to be. I'm just little old me, so don't have those kind of expectations on me. And yet, so often when we say to somebody, I love you, it contains all those expectations, or at least a great many of them. And then, of course, other people, being sentient, the sentient beings that they are, cannot fulfill all of our expectations, and then we get mad at them. I thought you were going to love me forever. Love meaning that you encourage me and do this and do that and that and that and that and that. And, you know, the other person can't do it. They're just a sentient being. So I think the real key to loving others is to drop our expectations about them, you know. Drop having an image of who we think they should be. And instead just care for them for whoever they are, however they act. And if we can do that, then we become a very trustworthy person. Because when we care for others just based on how they treat us, we're not always so trustworthy and stable because our own interests are first and we will turn on others. But when we're able to focus on others and care for them simply because they exist, then they can trust our affection. They can trust what we do. So this is actually one of the reasons they say the Buddha is a trustworthy object of refuge. Because the Buddha doesn't change how he feels about others or how he cares for others based on how others treat him. Yeah, somebody may praise the Buddha, somebody may harm the Buddha. The Buddha cares for both people equally. Yeah. Would you like to have that quality? To be able to care for everybody equally, no matter whether they praised you or criticized you. Boy, I would like that. I'd like to be that kind of person, you know, just to be completely emotionally stable and, you know, and trustworthy in that respect. So when we do the four immeasurables and say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes, we're trying to put our mind in that kind of state where we really care for others simply because they exist. And we try and make that kind of loving kindness just our basic general approach to sentient beings. Now think about that. What would it be like, just imagine for a minute, to whoever, no matter what person you met, how they looked, what they were doing, how they were treating you, your basic approach to them was, I want you to have happiness and its causes. Okay, so it doesn't matter if somebody's coming and giving you a chocolate birthday cake or if somebody is going to mug you. Your response to that person is, I want you to have happiness and its causes. That seems really counterintuitive to normal sentient beings. Like, what do you mean? You're going to mug me and I want you to have happiness and its causes? I'm terrified. I don't want you to have happiness and causes. I want to beat you up. Yeah. But imagine, what would it be like to have that approach to somebody? I mean, just in your heart, instead of fearing other people, instead of being suspicious of them, yeah, your general basic approach is one of, I want you to have happiness and its causes. Yeah. Now, somebody's probably going to say, then they're going to take advantage of me. Somebody's going to mug me. I want them to have happiness and its causes. Do I just give my wallet to them? Well, it's an option, you know. If they have a gun, I think it might be a very viable option. You know, give them what they want. Somebody told me this story recently that she was getting mugged. And the guy was clearly very aggressive and had a weapon of some sort. And she just looked at him and said, you know, there's nothing I can do to defend myself. If you want to take things, that's, you know, there's nothing I can do. And she just looked him in the eye and said that in a very calm way. And the guy turned around and left. Isn't that amazing? Yeah, I think sometimes people, when they're mugging or that kind of thing, they feed on others' fear. So sometimes this approach of loving kindness may actually be the thing that dispels the situation. You know, they talk about a situation in the Buddha's life. The Buddha had a cousin who was very jealous of him, who was constantly doing things to try and get in the way and even kill the Buddha. So one time, this cousin unleashed a wild elephant who went charging directly towards the Buddha. And the Buddha meditated on loving kindness for the elephant. And as the story goes, this charging elephant then suddenly dropped to his knees and bowed down to the Buddha. Yeah. So I don't know if elephants really do that. But the point of the story is that there's great power to loving kindness. Yeah. Again, loving kindness and compassion, they're not wimpy things. They're extremely powerful. Many people tell me, or have told me, that they've never met the Dalai Lama at all, but they go to a public talk, and His Holiness walks on stage, And they don't know why, but they start crying. Has that happened to anybody here? Yeah? So I think this is because of the power of His Holiness's love and compassion. You know? You just feel it. So it can be very, very healing to when somebody loves us in that way. Yeah? And even though that person doesn't love us specially, in other words, we are not a special person above and beyond everybody else, we realize we don't have to be, because the power of, you know, that realized being's love pervades to everybody. And that in itself is something very healing for us. So this is a quality, I don't know about you, but I would like to have. I think it'd be really wonderful to spread that, you know, when you go about just doing what you're doing in your life. If you're a person who has kindness and love, you know, often just you're doing very simple actions, nothing special, but the way you're doing them, the whole vibe, whatever that means about you, you know, influences other people. Okay? So, you know, we practice trying to love others in this way. Now, what is it that gets in the way of loving others? What's the chief thing that gets in the way? What's the opposite? Self-centeredness. And specifically, what? What is it that blocks, the biggest thing that blocks you from caring for others? I'll give you a clue. It starts with an A. Anger. Okay? Isn't anger the biggest obstacle to really connecting with others and caring for them? You know, anger is the very opposite of caring. Anger is, I want to strike at you, or I want to get away from you. So anger is a big problem. Yeah? Anybody here have problems with anger? If you don't raise your hand, then please, I offer you this seat and you teach the rest. Yeah, because I have a problem with anger too. So we really need to look at, you know, what triggers our anger and why we're getting angry. And like I was saying yesterday, even if somebody harms us, why do we tell ourselves, you know, the only way to respond is to get angry? I need to get angry. Yeah. Why do we use that syllogism of, I'm going to get angry because they, you know, deliberately wanted to hurt me? That syllogism doesn't make any sense. They want to hurt us, so what? Why do we need to hate them for it? Well, because our mind goes, because they want to hurt me! Or they want to hurt somebody else I love. Yeah. But again, this all boils down. It comes back to the self-centeredness. Okay? If, let's say, Joe's sitting right there. Yeah? Visualize Joe. So somebody walks in the room and says, Joe, you know, you're a total jerk. I trusted you with this project. You let me down. You didn't do it on time. You didn't let me know you weren't going to do it. Then you lied about the whole process. And, you know, I'm really angry. Okay. So if Joe's our friend, first of all, if Joe's our enemy, we go, good. Yeah, glad that person told him. We're really nice people, aren't we? Yeah. But if Joe's our friend, then we say, oh, you know, and because Joe's starting to get mad, we say, you know, don't worry about it. That person is just dumping their own anger and frustration on you. You don't need to get bent out of shape because of it. You know, just chill out. Don't worry about it. You know, the guy's just, you know, babbling. So that's what we say to Joe. Now imagine the same person walks in the room, and instead of looking at Joe and saying, hey, Joe, you did blah, 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 that person looks at us and says, hey, and uses your name and says, you know, you're a jerk and I counted on you and you didn't come through and you didn't let me know and then you talk bad about me behind my back or whatever it is. Then how do you feel? Do you say to yourself, oh, he's just, you know, kind of mouthing off, expressing his own pain. It's nothing, it's not a big deal. Do you say that to yourself? No. This has become a national issue. The most important thing that happened today. Yeah. Forget the war in Syria. Forget the missing airplane. I don't know how they lost an airplane, but anyway. You know, forget that. Forget, you know, the refugees in Africa. The most important thing happening today is that somebody accused me unfairly of doing something I did not do. And I am angry, and I am going to let them know. Yeah, and I am going to give them a taste of their own medicine because somebody needs to do it. And out of compassion for them, yeah, because I'm such a compassionate person, I'm going to give them a taste of their own medicine and put them in their place so they don't treat other living beings like this. Yeah? How much time do we spend in our life with that kind of mental state? Yeah? We have a precious human life with all the conditions to be able to meet the Dharma, practice the Dharma, develop impartial love and compassion for everybody. And instead, we spend our time furious at somebody else for what they did. Is that a good use of our time? You know, because our time is our most precious possession. Material things come, come, go, go. You know, our time is very precious. Is that a good use of our time? Yeah? Are we creating the causes to become the kind of person we want to be when we follow that angry mind? No. Okay. So, when we see ourselves in that mental state, do not get angry at yourself for getting angry at others. Okay? Because that just, you know, it's like compounded interest. Yeah, compounded problems. I hate myself because I hate you. You know, hating yourself doesn't make you stop hating somebody else. Yeah. You need to kind of, you know, step back from the situation and say, I care for myself. Is being angry helping me to care for myself? Is anger actually furthering even my own goals? Yeah, if I have a goal to become a kind person, is anger furthering me in that goal? If I have a goal to be close to this other person, so yesterday we were talking about how we sometimes say the most awful things to the people we love the most. Did we talk about that yesterday? Yeah. So, you know, does being angry at that person help me to be close to them? No. Yeah. Does anger make me happy? No. It gives me a lot of energy, because the adrenaline's going. Yeah. But does it make me feel peaceful and content and satisfied and fulfilled inside? Hardly. What kind of actions do I do when I'm angry? Yeah, constructive actions that are, you know, constructive karma that are going to create, that create the cause for happiness, or destructive actions that create the cause for suffering. Yeah. So we just kind of talk to ourselves and say, you know, is anger really furthering my own deepest heartfelt aspirations? No. And I care for myself, and I want to attain my heartfelt aspirations. And anger is a big impediment. So I don't hate myself for being angry. I don't feel guilty for being angry. But with wisdom, I realize that anger is, you know, it's a big pain in the neck. So let's work on overcoming it. And as I said yesterday, we have to really practice again and again and again to create new mental habits and look at situations in a different way in order to overcome our anger. Just coming to a teaching isn't going to do it. Just practicing the antidote once isn't going to do it. We have to really create a new habit of mind. I have a little slogan that I will share with you that helps me a lot when I start to get angry. It's called, sentient beings do what sentient beings do. Okay, so a sentient being is somebody who's not a Buddha. And sentient being, you know, and sentient beings, at least the common sentient beings, are overwhelmed with confusion, ignorance, anger, attachment, jealousy, arrogance, laziness, pretension, deception. You know, all these kind of qualities, you know, they're overwhelmed by their mental afflictions in the same way I am. So sentient beings do what sentient beings do. People who are overwhelmed by mental afflictions misbehave. Not because they're bad people, not because they want to hurt others, but because their mental afflictions just overpower them. So why do I expect them to be perfect? Sentient beings do what sentient beings do. They make a mess. Yeah? Don't you think? Do you make a mess? I make a mess. Why do I expect everybody else to be perfect? Anyway, what's the definition of perfect? Yeah, definition of perfect is people do what I want them to do when I want them to do it. That's the definition of perfect. Isn't it? Yeah? Our definition of perfect. Not a very good definition, but it's the one we hold to. Okay? So I say, you know, why am I expecting sentient beings to be what I want them to be and do what I want them to do when they're overwhelmed by mental afflictions? And I know from my own life experience what it's like to be overwhelmed by mental afflictions. Yeah, because when anger arises in my mind, I harm others, thereby harming myself. When attachment arises in my mind, I consider only my own benefit and forget about others. Yeah. When jealousy arises in my mind, I want to destroy others' happiness. I know what it's like to have strong mental afflictions. And yet I consider myself a good person and these mental afflictions, you know, getting in my way. So can I look at the other person and say, you know, they have the Buddha nature, they have the pure nature of mind, but these mental afflictions are getting in their way. And they haven't encountered the Dharma, or they haven't had the opportunity to practice the Dharma well enough to overcome these mental afflictions. So actually, rather than be angry at them, compassion is actually a more appropriate response to beings who are overwhelmed by suffering and the causes of suffering. Okay, so you talk to yourself. Yeah, you use sound reasoning, a proper, appropriate way of thinking to help yourself see the situation from a different way that's more realistic and more beneficial. You practice that, repeating it again and again and again, and eventually it becomes habitual. Okay? But when you think of the benefits of having that kind of attitude, yeah? I mean, think about it for a minute. What would it be like to not get angry no matter how others treated you? I mean, just imagine how that would feel. People could call you names, they could betray your trust, they could do whatever, and anger does not arise in your heart. Instead, compassion does. Wouldn't that be nice? Don't you think? Wow. I think that'd be so nice. And that doesn't mean people are going to take advantage of you. Because like I said, compassion and love, they're very clear thinking. Yeah? Genuine love and compassion, you're not a people pleaser. People pleasing, you know what people pleasing is? Is that an expression that Aussies have? Okay. I'm trying to think of how to say it in Australian. Volunteers become volleys. People pleasers, people pleasies. You know, you have nappies and everything is, yeah. Okay, so people pleasies. It doesn't mean you become like that. Because a people pleaser is not genuinely caring for other people. A people pleaser is acting out of fear and attachment. They want somebody else to like them. They're afraid of others not liking them. Or they're afraid of others criticizing them. So they try and do what they think other people want them to do so that other people will like them and won't threaten them. So you see, the motivation for people-pleasing is quite self-centered. Yeah. Whereas when we have genuine love and compassion, we're not doing it because we want somebody else to like us or we're afraid of them, you know, harming us with their words or even physically harming us. We're doing it because we genuinely care. Yeah. So that brings a lot of power. Because when we're nice to people out of fear and attachment, then other people can very easily manipulate us. Because we're just trying to, you know, keep ourselves safe and make sure they like us and make sure they treat us well and make sure they don't leave us. So we're very easily manipulated, trying to fulfill what we think they think we should do. But when we have straightforward love, people can't hook us with anything. Yeah? Because we're not attached to what they think of us. Yeah? We're just being who we are. So we don't bite other people's hooks. They can't manipulate us. Whatever we do, we're doing it from a genuine place in our hearts. In the prison work I do, when I talk about this kind of thing, the guys go, "You don't understand what it means to be in prison." No, If you're in the chow line and some guy comes in front of, cuts in front of you in the chow line, if you don't stand up to him, he's going to really take advantage of you. And all of his friends are going to take advantage of you. And so somebody, you know, cutting in front of you in the chow line, you've got to stand up and fight that person. Yeah, you don't back down and, you know, have a loving mind. That's what the guys say to me. And my response is, if you stand up to them, it's because, you know, you have fear in your heart. That person is thriving on your fear. If they're challenging you in that way, you know, cutting in line to assert themselves as most superior, you know, over you, and you're afraid, they thrive on that. But if in your heart you're completely balanced and you say, you would like to go first in line, that's fine with me, please, I offer my place to you. And if you do that with dignity, not out of fear, but with dignity, that person has nothing to feed on. Yeah. And the guys look at me like, oh, you're crazy. Yeah. But I really believe that, you know, if you can do that, you know. There's, how many of you have read the book Tattoos on the Heart? Any of you read it? I really recommend it. It's written by a Catholic priest who goes to work in the barrios in the intercity area of Los Angeles. And it's an area of town that is very impoverished, many gangs, incredible amount of teenage violence, and so on. And, you know, he just goes, he doesn't live in the nice part of town and commute to that there. He lives there. And he actually started a business called the Homeboy Business, you know. And he employs all the guys from the gangs to work. They have a bakery and they do other sorts of things. It's really quite amazing. Anyway, and he helps the families, he helps the guys there as much as he can, and drives them different places when they need to go. And somebody said to this Catholic father, he said, aren't they taking advantage of you? And his response was, I give my advantage away. I give my advantage away. So that's kind of a koan for me, you know, this is a puzzle. I give my advantage away. He was not afraid of anybody taking advantage of him, even though his way of relating to many of the guys, other people would say they're taking advantage of you. He said, I give my advantage away. He was doing what he was doing with choice, with a completely free heart, not being bound by attachment or fear or anything else. I thought, yeah, I think I want to be like that. Okay, that was our brief introduction. Any questions about that so far? Anything? Yeah.
I was just curious, your prison example,
Did you try it? I haven't heard back yet if they tried it. I think they're too afraid to try it. Yeah. But I really think it will work. I think sometimes when you're not afraid, when you just treat people directly, it has a strong effect. Let me tell you a couple of other stories about that, you know, people not having fear. I heard a story of a woman walking across Central Park in the evening. This is not a smart thing to do. Yeah, it's crime-ridden in the evening. Anyway, she was carrying a bunch of things, walking across the park, and she hears some guy stalking her, following her across the park. She still had a ways to go to get to the other side. So she was carrying these parcels. So she turned around and she looked at the guy and she said, "Here, can you help me carry these?" and handed them to him and kept walking. And the guy was so surprised, he followed her carrying the things. She got to the other end of the park where there, you know, was a street. She turned around again and said, "Thank you very much," and took the parcels and went on. Yeah. I heard another story about a woman walking in New York, and again, you know, some guy following her saying, you know, "Hey, babe, come on, you know, let's go out tonight, let's have a good time," and really coming on to her in quite a nasty way. And she turned around and looked at him and said, "Sorry, I'm busy tonight," and kept walking. And again, you know, it was just, she just directly dealt with me. "Sorry, I'm busy tonight. Maybe another time." Yeah? So I think there's something to, you know, when our minds don't feel fear. Yeah? But fear is another difficult emotion to handle, isn't it? And, you know, scientists tell us we're hardwired with fear in our brainstem and, you know, wherever it is. But I think it's possible to subdue that fear. I think it's possible to lessen it. Okay, then there's a question that I'll deal with here, and then we'll see what happens if we get to the text this hour. Okay, so this is a very good question. What is the relation between the three poisons and the self-centeredness and the self-grasping? Okay, so the three poisons of ignorance, anger, and attachment, the self-centeredness and the self-grasping. And also kind of implicit in this question is, what's the difference between self-centeredness and self-grasping? You know, so, because we often hear that these, self-grasping is the root of suffering. Self-centeredness is the cause of all our suffering. The three poisonous minds are, you know, cause all our problems. We hear, you know, the same thing said of these three things, but they're also different. Okay, so the self-grasping ignorance is the root of samsara, and this is what incorrectly apprehends how things exist, the actual mode of existence of people and other phenomena. Okay, the self-grasping, things exist dependent on other things. Self-grasping apprehends them or grasps at them as existing as independent from other things, as having their own nature, their own mode of being, of being self-enclosed or self-powered, when in fact everything exists in relationship to other things. Okay, so self-grasping is the fundamental misapprehension of the actual mode of being of people and phenomena. Due to self-grasping, we then have the three poisonous minds, okay, of ignorance, anger, and attachment. Actually, ignorance there, it's, there's a Tibetan word, timug, okay, and sometimes it's translated as ignorance, sometimes as confusion or even bewilderment. The Tibetan word, mirigpa, is always translated as ignorance, it seems. But the word timug can sometimes be synonymous with Marigpa and refer to, you know, this in the three poisonous attitudes. If we, let's say confusion there, you know, confusion, attachment, and anger. The confusion there, confusion, not necessarily in the perspective of the three poisonous attitudes, but the word confusion can sometimes be synonymous with ignorance and refer to that misapprehension of reality. In the context of the three poisonous minds, confusion there usually refers to confusion about karma and its effects. Confusion not about the ultimate nature of being, but confusion about the conventional nature and how things function. So due to not understanding the difference between what is wholesome and what is not wholesome, between what to practice on the path and what to abandon on the path, okay? Not understanding that our actions have an ethical dimension, not understanding that what we do and what we think creates our reality, that kind of confusion, okay? So that kind of confusion is the basis for all of our misdeeds and negative karma, okay? And it arises out of the self-grasping ignorance that is the root of cyclic existence, okay? Attachment also arises out of that self-grasping ignorance, because when we grasp at ourself, the I, not this I, but the big I, yeah, as being independent, then automatically we are attached to the welfare of that I. You know, and I want to be happy. You know? And my happiness is most important. And we have to protect that I. So we get attachment, we get greed, we get the mind that is pulling what we see as desirable inward towards us. Okay? When that attachment gets frustrated and we can't get what we want, then anger arises. So that's the third of the three poisonous attitudes. Yeah, so then anger is like, you got in the way of I, me, getting what I want, so you're a threat to me, so I strike, I fight or I flee. Okay? So that's one way of explaining it. Then with a self-centered attitude, okay? Self-centered attitude, there's different levels of it, okay? And it's spoken of in different ways. In general, okay, the self-centered attitude is the mind that says, I am more important than anybody else. My welfare is more important. My happiness is more important. My suffering hurts more. You know, the self-centeredness is I am the center of the universe. Okay? Now, the very gross self-centeredness works in cahoots with the self-grasping ignorance and feeds the ignorant, the confusion, the anger, and the attachment, and all the other afflictions. Okay, so if we look, you know, beneath all of our afflicted mental states, you know, there's the self-grasping ignorance, which is their root, and the self-centered mind that is nudging them along. Okay? So this kind of self-centeredness is a very gross aspect of self-centeredness. And we can see it all the time, you know, in our life, because everything is about me. I'm the center of the universe. Okay. Then there's also a subtle kind of self-centeredness. And this kind of self, the subtle self-centeredness, thinks our liberation from samsara is more important than other beings' liberation. Okay. The gross self-centeredness is very much focused on the pleasures and the good things to come from cyclic existence. But the subtle self-centeredness is focused on liberation, saying my liberation is more important than others. Okay. And so we say that that is the kind of subtle self-centeredness that an arhat may have, an arhat being somebody who has eliminated all the afflictions. Okay, they no longer have confusion, anger, attachment, or the ignorance that's the root of samsara. But they still have this subtle self-centeredness because they're very happy that they're liberated and they're not committed to hanging around and helping everybody else to be liberated as well. Okay? So that's a subtle kind of self-centeredness. In the Mahayana scriptures, you'll often see arhats kind of looked down upon for having this subtle self-centeredness. But and from the viewpoint of being a bodhisattva, it certainly is more worthwhile to be a bodhisattva than to just aspire for our own liberation. Okay? However, that does not mean that our hearts are selfish. Yeah, in a gross form of selfishness. In the subtle form of selfishness of preferring their own liberation and not willing to undergo hardship for the benefit of others' liberation. In that sense, they are selfish. But, just as living beings, they tend to be much more generous and much kinder than us. Yeah. So we shouldn't put our hearts down and say, I'm a Mahayana practitioner. I'm so much better than you. Because that's clearly an indication of our afflictions, isn't it? And arhats have eliminated those kinds of afflictions. So it's very good to respect arhats. And yet, at the same time, we want to go beyond their state, as bodhisattva practitioners or as bodhisattva aspirants, as Mahayana aspirants. We want to really work for the liberation and the full awakening of each and every sentient being, not just ourselves. Yeah? I'm sorry, can you speak louder? I'm not hearing everything you're saying.
Sorry, I actually just want to respond to the subtle ignorance you're talking about.
Yeah.
And my focus is, I just want to understand this for myself, and my focus is to get me okay, so that I can go out in the world and perform my roles as a father and as a person who works in schools and so on in a really powerful way. If I'm not okay, I can't do that. So I'm just wondering how that taps into your subtle ignorance.
Okay, could somebody, my hearing's not so good. Can somebody?
So he's concerned about the subtle self-grasping,
okay.
Subtle self-cherishing. He's saying that he wants to get himself okay so that he can go out in the world and do the work that he wants to do.
Yeah.
So I think
there's
a misunderstanding about what
Okay. So you want to free yourself from liberation, free yourself from cyclic existence, so that you can work for the benefit of others. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I certainly want to be a better place so I can do it.
Yeah, Okay, yeah, because if you're in a better place, then of course you can be of more service to others. This actually is the bodhicitta aspiration, okay? Except that you're not just saying, I want to be liberated myself so I can help others. You're saying, I want to attain full awakening so I can really be of the greatest benefit. Okay, that's the bodhicitta aspiration. Yeah, not just my own. Because, see, when you're an arhat, you've eliminated all the afflictions, but you haven't eliminated the subtle stains on the mind. So those subtle stains interfere with your being of the greatest benefit to other living beings. So if your compassion is strong, then you also want to eliminate those subtle stains that the arhats still have. Okay, does that answer your question okay?
But how do you do that?
How do you do that? That's what we're here to learn. Okay, yeah, how do we do that? We practice, you know, what this text is teaching. So on one hand, we have to develop the bodhicitta. On the other hand, we have to develop the wisdom understanding the nature of reality, those two chief components. Okay? The path is long and complicated. So I can't, that was the 25 word or less version. Okay? Okay. Let's just talk some more. For some reason, usually I start things with meditation. I don't know what you guys are doing to me, but you're making me talk a lot. Okay. So, verse 13. Oh, this is a good one. We got to get to this one. When unpleasant words reach my ears, it is the wheel of evil karma turning upon me for my verbal offenses, such as divisive speech. From now on, I will condemn flawed speech. Oh, when unpleasant words reach my ears. You know, people criticize me, people disapprove of me, they blame me when I didn't do anything wrong, they accuse me of doing things I didn't do, you know, they don't appreciate me, they nitpick, they nag, they blame. You know, I don't do any of those things. Yeah, but I have to live with all these people and their unpleasant words. Okay. So, you know, usually when these unpleasant words reach our ears, we talked about it yesterday, we get angry, we're furious, we strike back at them, we withdraw, we feel sorry for ourselves. We have a whole variety of techniques. You know, do any of them work? No. Yeah. So what works is to say, this is the wheel, you know, of sharp weapons, of my own karma. It is the boomerang effect of my karma coming back at me. Yeah. Because I have, committed a lot of verbal misdeeds, such as divisive speech. Okay, so in the verbal misdeeds, there's four main ones. Okay, first one is lying. But we don't lie, do we? Yeah, we just adjust the truth for the benefit of somebody else so that we don't hurt their feelings, right? Yeah, but we don't lie. Yeah. When we adjust things, it's really for somebody else's benefit. And then we wonder why other people lie to us. Lying is of all the non-virtues, lying, I think, is a double jeopardy kind of thing. Because there's the initial thing we did that we don't want somebody to know about, which usually is something not good. So that's why we don't want other people to know about it. And then we lie on top of it, and we don't want other people to know we lied. Okay? If you want a good lesson in this, ask Bill Clinton. Yeah? There's the initial offense, and then there's the lie about it. What happens when we lie? It's very difficult to pull off a good lie for a long time. Because if you lie, you have to have a very good memory. Because you say one thing to one person and one thing to another person. So you have to remember which version you told who, so the next time it comes up, you repeat it the same way. Yeah. If you don't have such a good memory, then you contradict yourself when you're lying. Then people become suspicious. Okay. Another thing about lying is that it's actually very difficult to pull one over on somebody for an extended period of time. Yeah, people find out. Yeah, most of your lies have, you know, when we've lied to people, most of the time they find out by one way or another. And then what happens? They don't trust us anymore. They lose faith in us. Because to me, you know, speaking personally, to me, when somebody lies to me, it means they don't trust me to be okay with the truth. Yeah. And actually, I'm okay with the truth. I can handle the truth. You know, please give me some credit. I can handle the truth. What I cannot handle is when people lie to me. Because to me, lying is an incredible break of trust. Now, if somebody lies to me, it means I cannot trust them with anything. And as we all know, it takes a long time to build up trust, doesn't it? Yeah, it takes a long time to build up trust in relationships. One lie can devastate trust built up over a long time. Yeah? Because for me, I don't, you know, if somebody lies, it really means I cannot trust them with anything. Yeah, because they don't think I'm okay with the truth. Yeah, they cannot be straightforward with me. And if somebody can't be straightforward with me, how can I have a relationship with them? Yeah? So, you know, I've been in situations where people have lied to me, and I'm always so puzzled why they lied, because what they're lying about, they don't need to lie about. If they had told me the truth, I would have been okay with it. But it was because they lied that then I stopped trusting them. Okay? So I think a lot of times, you know, with our lies, even the little white lies that we tell, why do we tell those white lies? I mean, to me, white lies are, they're really like saying to somebody, you know, I think you're an imbecile and you can't handle the truth. Somebody calls you on the phone, you're busy, so you tell whoever answers the phone, tell them I'm not here. You know, because you don't want to take the phone call at that time. What's the problem with saying tell them I'm busy? Is somebody really going to get hurt if you tell them you're busy? People understand that. Why do you need to say I'm not here? You just say, I'm busy. They understand. Yeah? So many of these kinds of things, I think, you know, we got to give people some credit that they can understand things and, you know, if we tell them the truth. Okay. Other times we lie because we want to put on a good image to somebody. And lying is especially counterproductive when we lie to our spiritual mentors or we lie to our Dharma friends, because those are the people who are going to help us. And if we can't tell them the truth, how can they help us? If we're trying to look good in front of our spiritual mentors instead of being honest with them about what's in our heart, how are they going to help us get rid of our afflictions? Okay, so lying really is very counterproductive if we're trying to develop spiritually. We need to be able to be completely straightforward, you know. The four verbal ones, one is lying. Then divisive speech is the second one. Divisive speech means creating disharmony with our speech. So it means there's many ways to be use divisive speech, and we are very creative with this one. So in an office situation, we may gang up on somebody else and make that person the black sheep and create a little network where we get everybody on our side against that person. Okay?
Like what?
Bullying.
Yeah, like bullying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like bullying. But we talk bad about somebody else to get others on our side. Yeah? And if you do this in a office situation, if you do this in a Dharma center, it creates havoc, you know? Because we're just blaming everything on one person. Nothing is ever one person's fault. And our motivation is really rotten, you know, because underlying it, we're thinking, if I can put that person down, then I'll look good. That's kind of nasty, isn't it? Yeah. Divisive speech is also two people are friends, and I don't want them to be friends. It's in my self-interest if they don't like each other so much. Yeah. Or I might be jealous of their friendship. So I tell this one something about that one to make them suspicious. And then I tell that one something about this one. And what I tell them may even be something true. I may not be lying. But I may use the truth to create division in their relationship. Okay. Again, with a pretty rotten motivation myself. Another kind of creating disharmony is I just don't like one person, so I badmouth them up, down, and across. Yeah, it's not so much that I want everybody on my side, but I just don't like somebody, and I want to give them headaches. And so we gossip about people behind their backs, and did you hear what so-and-so did? Did you hear what so-and-so? Can you believe? Why is this person acting this way? Oh, my goodness, you know. They shouldn't do that. They should do this. And in turn, you know, we turn that person against the other person. Sometimes we use divisive speech because we're angry or we're upset and we just vent on somebody else. You know, vent just to, you know, get it off our chest on somebody else, telling them about what so-and-so did to us. Yeah. In this case, yeah, if you're just venting and it has, you know, and your motivation is, I just want to feel better and get this off my chest, and I don't care what happens to this person's relationship with the person who harmed me, that is definitely divisive speech. Yeah. You may think, well, I'm just getting it off my chest, but it's having the effect of turning the listener against the person who you don't like. On the other hand, sometimes we may be angry and we may be disturbed, but we can go to a Dharma friend and we can say, a situation happened to me that I'm really disturbed about. I'm angry about it. I'm hurt. I want to tell you about it. My purpose for telling you is so that you can help me with my anger. My purpose in telling you is not to turn you against this person, because I clearly see here that my anger is my problem. So in that situation, you're going to a Dharma friend, and you may tell them, you know, this situation happened with so-and-so and this and that. But your motivation is for that friend to help you with your hurt and your anger. Your motivation is not to turn that person against the other person. Okay, so that's a different kind of situation. And you're making it clear from the get-go. And we do need to talk to our Dharma friends sometimes when we're upset, because sometimes we may just get really stuck and not be able to work it out ourselves. And talking about it helps. Okay, but we have to be clear in our motivation. Then the third verbal non-virtue is harsh words. Yeah, yelling at someone, screaming at them, ridiculing them, making fun of them. Yeah, this kind of thing. A kind of speech that hurts others' feelings. So divisive words is usually said to somebody else. Harsh words is usually said directly to the person. Okay. Sometimes we use a lot of harsh words, even with kids. I've seen adults take great pleasure in teasing children and making children afraid. You know, they think it's so funny. Let's get the little three-year-old afraid of the big boogeyman. You know, hee hee hee, isn't that cute? You know, that's really harsh speech, you know, playing on a child's innocence to make them afraid of something. Okay, so ridiculing, teasing people in a nasty way. You know, there's a friendly way of teasing people. But the problem, you know, because I like to tease people, and for me, teasing is a symbol that I'm close to somebody. But I have learned the hard way that often people do not take it as an indication of my friendliness. But they are, you know, genuinely offended by my teasing them. So I have to be very careful about that, because, you know, they get upset. They don't realize I'm teasing. And then the fourth kind of verbal non-virtue is idle talk. Yeah. Sometimes they translate it as gossip, but it's not just gossip, because gossip can also be a form of divisive speech. But it's really talking when you don't need to talk. Okay, it's like blah 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 blah, because I like to hear myself talk. Yeah, have you ever been on the phone with somebody who just likes to hear themselves talk? Yeah, and you need to do something, and that person's going on and on and on. Now, I know none of us are like that. We never bore people with our stories. Or do we? Yeah. So, you know, it's a thing of learning to be sensitive. Is this really the right time to be speaking to somebody, or does somebody else actually need some silent time right now? Is what I'm saying something that is important for the other person to know, or am I just getting off on the fact that, boy, I have all this information, you know, about what's going on with so-and-so, so I must be a kind of important person if I know all of this, and then I can tell other people, did you know what so-and-so, and this and that, and the other thing, and that makes me look big, because I know what's going on with other people's affairs. Idle talk, oh, sorry to say this, it's also talking about, you know, things that that, again, the motivation is just to hear ourselves talk about things that are not really so important to talk about, like sales, you know. Did you hear? You can get the latest this and that here, you know. Sports, politics, a lot of things, you know. So I'm not saying you never talk about sports, politics, and this kind of stuff. I'm saying we have to look at our motivation. Yeah. Clearly, I think national affairs, international affairs, we do need to talk about. Yeah, we are citizens, we vote, we elect officials, we need to be informed. So we need to talk about these things. But the way we talk about them can either be, you know, a way of talking, you know, a respectful way of talking about them, or it can be a very cynical way of talking about things, or it can just be a blah blah way of talking. In the U.S., we take great delight in putting our politicians down. Do you do that here?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It is one of our national pastimes of, you know, how to make fun of our politicians. And actually, if I can make a comment about the U.S. Congress and how it's functioning, or rather not functioning, you know, you can, sometimes there's a reason for people speaking this way. But again, we have to you know, we may use these people as the butt of jokes and so on, but I think if we're doing it in a playful way, it's very different than if we're doing it with genuine hostility or genuine cynicism. Okay? You know, there's a way do you get what I mean? Can you tell the difference between talking about politicians or, you know, the guys on Wall Street when you're really angry and bitter and mad and cynical versus when you're just kind of like, better laugh at this because otherwise we're going to cry. Yeah, there's a difference there in the mental state. And then, you know, sometimes disagreeable things need to be talked about. They need to be brought out in the open. You know, if somebody is misbehaving, you need to bring it out and not just cover it up. Yeah. So again, you know, if it's Wall Street people or if it's religious people. I mean, what happened in the Catholic Church with the sexual abuse and the covering up of the sexual abuse? That needs to get brought out. That needs to be discussed. Okay. Again, there's a way of discussing it where we're angry and bitter and cynical and just want to inflict harm. And there's a way of discussing it where we genuinely care about the victims and about the perpetrators and about the church itself, and, you know, we want to see a good resolution to the situation, and we know that we need to speak out against something that is harmful for sentient beings' welfare. Okay, so in the thing about, you know, not having idle talk, not talking behind other people's back and so on, we really need a great deal of discriminating wisdom. I remember one time I was talking to Lama Yeshe, and he was visiting a center where I was living, and he was asking me, you know, how is this person, what's happening here, what's happening there? And he asked me about one person who, you know, in my opinion, was not behaving very well and had some problems. But I thought, oh no, I don't want to say anything bad about this person to our teacher, because that would be gossiping, that would be harsh words, or that would be a divisive speech. And so I kind of, you know, froze, and I said, you know, I just kind of, you know, glossed it over. And Lama immediately picked up on it. And he said, You know, you need to tell me what's happening truthfully. Yeah. And then I realized that, yes, he was right. I did need to tell him what was going on, because Lama's motivation was to benefit that person. And so if I told Lama with a motivation also for that person to be benefited, and not because I was just gossiping and wanted to get them in trouble, you know, then there was a reason for me saying that. So, you know, we do have to sometimes discuss unpleasant things. I'm not saying cover stuff up and pretend it doesn't happen, because that is not healthy. Yeah. So, but it is a challenge of how do we talk about unpleasant things in a respectful way with concern for everybody involved. It can be a challenge to us. Also, in terms of idle talk, you know, somebody can think, oh, well, okay, I can't talk about sports and shopping and business and movies and television, and so then the only thing I can ever talk about with people is Dharma or some kind of intense, meaningful topic. But, you know, not every situation is it appropriate to talk about these things. You know, if you work in an office, yeah, are you going to talk with the people that you see every day about some intense, meaningful topic when you're, you know, both getting some coffee or tea to drink? That's not appropriate. Yeah. So, you know, with many people, we need to just talk about these kind of common things that are ordinarily considered idle talk, but we are aware that we do it with the motivation to create connection to the other person, not just to waste time, not to hear ourselves talk, but because this is the way in common conventional society that you create a relationship with people. Okay. When I go home to visit my family, yeah, I have to talk about these things. Otherwise, there's nothing to talk about, because they aren't interested in the Dharma, you know? So we, you know, I don't know anything about movies, you know, but I'll sit down with my dad and watch the baseball game. I really couldn't care at all about where that ball goes, you know? But what I find fascinating is I love to watch the expression on, like, especially the pitcher, you know, how they zoom in, and this pitcher, this poor guy, is like so stressed out. Yeah, do you know what I talk about? I mean, do you watch baseball here? Oh, you don't. You watch cricket. Do they zoom in? I don't know what cricket is. Do they zoom in on the cricket players' faces, you know? And they're like so stressed and so tense and, you know, I've got to really do something with this ball that's the right thing for my team, because my whole reputation and existence is dependent on this, you know? And to me, it's just fascinating to watch how people get so involved and so stressed and think it's so important about what happens to this ball, you know? So, you know, I'll talk with my dad about football, about baseball. Yeah, with my nephew, I have to do it about football. I do not understand football, you know? I mean, it's like, who cares? But, you know, if I'm going to communicate with people, I have to talk about what's of interest with them. You know, when I first met one of my teachers, you know, the first person who became one of my teachers, the first thing he talked to me about was dolphins. Because I was taking somebody else to the LA airport to pick up the person who was her teacher. I knew nothing about Buddhism. I was taking her, you know. He came out He had just been in Hawaii at, I don't know, SeaWorld or something. And, you know, and he talked to me about dolphins because that was the level of my mind, you know. And but that was the way you create a relationship with somebody. So, you know, we can talk about all sorts of things with people with the motivation to create a relationship. Yeah. But it's, you know, to really check our motivation. Okay? Well, we did one verse. And we didn't meditate. So you're going to meditate next hour. Okay? Let's do the dedication. And again, if you have questions that we didn't get to, feel free to, you know, leave them on the table. So I think it's 17, yeah. May I quickly become Guru Lord Buddha and lead each and every sentient being into his enlightened realm because of these merits. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta, which has not arisen, arise and grow. And may that which has arisen never diminish, but increase more and more.